Welcome to The Spot, KALW's weekly space for the best in public radio podcasts and storytelling. I'm your host, Ashley Ann Krigbaum. It's the middle of the night, and you've somehow snuck your way into SF MoMA's storage facilities. You make your way around the large, chilly room, snaking around rows and rows of tenderly packed boxes. As you walk past, you read the names printed on each one. Brancusi, Cornell, Kahlo, and then you stop when you see Kandinsky. The box beckons you to open it, so you look over your shoulders, checking for security guards. There aren't any. There is nothing stopping you from gingerly pulling apart the tape around the outside until foam packaging starts bouncing out of the box. The smell of century-old ink and wood hits your nose, and you find at the bottom of the box, swaddled in muslin, a frame, 15 inches high and 11 inches wide. Your heart races as you pull the fabric away from the frame, revealing black ink on yellowed paper. There are shapes of all kinds that curve and squiggle, mashing together with parallel lines, surrounded by dots and scribbles that remind you of stars. 50 years before Kandinsky created Kleine Welten 12, the artist wasn't an artist. He was a lawyer with zero artistic training under his belt. It took a bolt of perspective, a singular physical experience that was so powerful and surprising that it changed the course of Vasily Kandinsky's life. The podcast Stylus takes us back to that moment of inspiration that happened on the streets of Moscow in the late 19th century. Here's art historian Ben Street.
So, it's 1896, and we're in Moscow, and we're at a theatre called the Bolshoi Theatre. And there's a young student in the audience, and his name is Vasily Kandinsky. He's about 30 years old. And he's at the theatre to see a performance of Wagner's Lohengrin. This is not unusual for him. He's a music fan. But while he listens to the music and when he leaves the theatre, he experiences something which is very odd, a transformative experience, a bit like a vision that changes his life. What's happening to Kandinsky is his first experience of synesthesia, the confusion of the senses that makes him see musical notes as colours. He described the experience later on by saying, "I saw all the colours in my mind. They stood before my eyes. Wild, almost crazy lines were sketched in front of me." So why did this happen? For Kandinsky, at that moment, there was a direct link between the musical note that he was hearing and the colour that seemed to pop and flash in front of his eyes. Now, that moment, when he's stumbling out of the theatre and it's a cold Russian evening with snow falling out of the sky, and he's having this vision, is a turning point in his life as well as in his art. Up to that point, you have to kind of imagine him as a rather studious, quite serious student, somebody who was studying for law and economics, and his future seemed to be completely mapped out. His future as a lawyer, a successful lawyer in Moscow, seemed to be pretty much sorted. He was married to his cousin, which at the time wasn't particularly frowned upon, and he was heading towards a pretty, not exciting, but fairly successful career in the law, but he always had this interest in the arts. And after he went to this particular concert, he decided to pull a real U-turn in his life and to leave for Munich to go and study art. His plan being, I suppose, to capture that experience that he'd had in the theatre in painting. In other words, to create paintings that had the quality of music. So the question is, what does music look like? Now, Kandinsky was not the first artist to ask himself that question. Artists had, in fact, been asking that question for probably over 100 years. But Kandinsky is the first artist to really follow that thought to its logical conclusion. Because if you're going to make a painting that has the quality of music, it really has to be abstract, like music is. It has to not represent anything at all. If you ever see any photographs of Kandinsky, he looks very professorial. He doesn't look like he's a lot of fun. He has his little pince-nez glasses slipping down his nose, and he looks incredibly serious. But this is somebody who was astoundingly radical. And the way he writes about art, although it's quite scholarly, it's still very engaging. He went through a list of colours, his most important colours. He said the colour yellow was like the sound of a trumpet. It was clear and sharp. The colour blue, depending on its tone, if it's a dark blue or a light blue, could either be a flute, or a cello, or a church organ. Red, again, it's sort of depending upon whether it's a very light red or a darker red. If it's a very dark red, it's going to be a tuba. If it's a very light red, it might be a violin. You can hopefully see, just by using yellow, red and blue together in a single painting, that you have the effect of a small orchestra already. But unfortunately, green was like, and I'm directly quoting Kandinsky here, green was like a fat, extremely healthy cow. So he doesn't tend to use green too much. I'll be proved wrong now. But I think that's pretty much true. Now, the thing about this, I mentioned Kandinsky being a great writer, being somebody who made almost manifestos out of this idea of synesthesia. Now, for Kandinsky, this is important. For Kandinsky, it's not just a question of style. It's not about just doing something new. It's actually part of a deeply held spiritual belief. He really believed that when he saw those images popping in front of his eyes, that they were really real. Not only that they were real, but that they had some kind of direct link to a kind of greater spiritual truth. The problem is, how do you do it? I mean, how do you actually paint music? How do you really do that? The key difference, of course, is to do with time. Because when you listen to a piece of music, obviously, it is unfolding over time, which is perhaps why Goethe, the great German philosopher and poet, called architecture frozen music. Because architecture, like music, unfolds over time as a person experiences it. But a painting is a very different thing, especially in Kandinsky's time. You see it all in one go. And that's potentially a bit of a problem if you want to represent or evoke music, isn't it? His way of rationalising it would be that a painting is kind of infinite too. It doesn't have a beginning or an end. And so the effect that it has can perhaps be more powerful because it isn't quite so narrative, I suppose. So I started by talking about the Wagner concert that Kandinsky attended. There's a second concert he goes to a little bit later on. It's when Kandinsky went to see a concert of Arnold Schoenberg, who later became a friend of Kandinsky's, was that the doors really got blown open for him. He went to see Schoenberg's concert at a ballroom in Munich, and in the concert, the third thing that Schoenberg played was a very recent piece that he'd composed called The Three Piano Pieces. And it was completely mind-blowing for Kandinsky. The experience that he'd had outside the Bolshoi Theatre in Moscow came back to him again. That experience of synesthesia was incredibly powerful. The music that Schoenberg had composed and that was being performed seem to have exactly what Kandinsky had been looking for in his paintings. It was creating its own kind of language. It was formless in a very captivating way. And it was utterly experimental and completely novel. So Kandinsky painted the concert. He made a series of sketches culminating in a painting called Impression 3, brackets concert, which he painted just a few days after that concert. So maybe January the 6th, 1911, something like that, right after seeing that concert. So the music was still reverberating in his brain when he sat down at his easel and started to paint this painting, which on the surface of it looks entirely abstract. A series of blotches of colour, a large swathe like a wave that runs across the painting in yellow. So that great trumpet sound. There are other blotches of colour, a hot red, a hot dark blue, beautiful oranges and jagged sky blue that runs through the painting. Cutting through the painting is an enormous black shape, which looks a lot like a shark's dorsal fin and is a painting of the piano that was being played during Schoenberg's concert. Once you know that's the piano, when you look at the painting, there are small humped forms, like little horseshoes, that you start to read as audience members. But it looks as though the whole of the concert hall has been flooded with light. And that's how it must have felt for Kandinsky. It must have felt as though the whole world had opened up for him. Often I find when I talk to people about abstract painting, people scratch their heads and they get angry or they get frustrated. But what Kandinsky entreated his viewers to do was not to think of it in the way that we often think of paintings, and not to think of it in the way we often think of writing, rather to experience it physically in the same way that he experienced music physically. He said, lend your ears to music, open your eyes to painting, and stop thinking. Just ask yourself whether the work has enabled you to walk about into a hitherto unknown world. If the answer is yes, what more do you want?
That was Ben Street, an art historian, lecturer, and freelance writer featured on the podcast Stylus from WBUR in Boston. The story was excerpted from a longer episode about vision and sound, which you can find at stylusradio.org, and you can find the podcast on iTunes. You're tuned to The Spot, KALW's weekly showcase of the best stories made by indie radio and podcast producers. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. In this next piece, we won't just imagine what life in a museum is like when the visitors leave and the lights go dark. Every day, thousands of people pass through the doors of the National Gallery in London. And every evening, a handful of men and women patrol the silent galleries, spending their nights with the likes of Cezanne, Rembrandt, Hepworth, Beale, Degas, Bacon, Monet.
Closing now, thank you. Can you make a move, please? Thank you.
Museums, even during their busiest hours, seem pretty sleepy. Guards like sentries, shuffling feet, hushed tones, all the stuff of reverence and import. At night, though, who can say what goes on? Plenty of movie makers have imagined fantastic ideas of art coming to life once the doors are locked. But really, isn't it all just two-dimensional art on the walls and drowsy security guards? Maybe. But then again, maybe not.
Go ahead, Michael. Can you give us a call in the control room, please?
My name is Joe. I've been a security warder for 26 years.
My name is Atmaram Kual. I've worked here for 28 years. I work as a control room security officer.
We start at 8 o'clock in the evening. At summertime, it's not too bad, but in the winter, it's rather darkish. Our job is to look around the ceilings and make sure that there's no leaks, and most of the time, make sure that the building is secure.
We are many, never silent, even in darkness, light sighs from our surfaces like sap from wounded trees. We demand your eyes and meet them with a multiplicity of our own. We are never alone.
My name is Tracy Chevalier. I'm the author of 5 novels, the best known being Girl with a Pearl Earring, which is a novel about a Vermeer painting. We're standing in a dark room with just a little light from the edge, and you can more or less make out the paintings, what they are. It does feel like they're all asleep. These paintings are asleep, and they've been here all day, and everybody's been looking at them, and they're exhausted. They don't want to tell their stories anymore, so it's dark, and they're quiet, and they're all sleeping just the way we do. And now we're going to wake them up.
I'm Marina Warner, and I'm a writer, principally, and I also teach at the University of Essex. One of the oldest ideas, probably, in mythology about art is that it comes to life. The best-known story is Ovid's Pygmalion. Pygmalion decides, it's a misogynist story. Pygmalion decides that all women are wanting, they lack the qualities that he most desires, so he creates, as a sculptor, a statue. And he loves his statue so much because she's exactly what he wants. I mean, this is not really a very nice story. And he begins to make love to the statue. And then, by a marvelous piece of poetry in Ovid's Metamorphoses, he feels the flesh turn warm under his fingers. And she steps down from her pedestal. So this idea that statues have this, really potent, uncanny life inside them belongs to, quite a lot of powerful stories that have had many, many different versions and variations written about them.
If you drink a painting for long enough, you can breathe it into life. We slip in and out of the landscapes, their swirling impressions of green pathways leading deep into other worlds as we breathe our mythic conversations. A language of starry nights and crucifixions, doorways within doorways, the magic of time travel after midnight, when the gardens breathe shifting skies, the horse gallops free from the frame, and we are no longer a single expression, a moment frozen. But all the hundreds of years that have danced in the moonlight, we echo to each other.
It's got this quality of silence that is rather different from total silence, and that's what's eerie. Something about the people who've all gone, the visitors, leaves behind some vibration in the air, but also that the quality of all these paintings changes the actual atmosphere technically, so that this is a living place, it doesn't turn dead at all. I wouldn't want to say that this was a kind of sacred feeling, but it's a kind of nuance of the sacred. There's something close to that. You feel awed and stirred. It's got a sort of musical quality. It touches you wordlessly.
Well, nighttime is good because nighttime, you can actually sit down and let your mind go and let the paintings take you over. You can actually let yourself go into the paintings. And sometimes you see things what you don't normally do. during the daytime, because during the daytime you've got the clutter of the people walking, of children whispering, and it's a kind of a buzzing noise in the gallery all the time. But at night time, it's peace, and the gallery is peace. And sometimes when there is peace, mind plays tricks.
When I go down that area, I feel my hair is go up, you know. Let's say it's 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the morning, it's so quiet down there. And suddenly when you hear some noise, you said, oh my God, what is it? You just feel so scary, you know. You want to get out of there as quick as possible.
But the areas I like to avoid is the basement area. I could hear a ball and chain following me all the time. And I was really scared because I don't normally believe in ghosts. But it had me going for a good year. Till once I was walking down there and I found out that it was the Victoria Line. It was the workers working on the lines at night time.
It's almost, the sounds are almost like a prison. You hear these doors kind of cranking shut and open, and these clunk, clunk, clunk of the feet going down. And it's like the paintings have been stuck here and they're imprisoned. And that's the funny thing about these paintings, is that they don't escape. You know, they don't escape the frame and they don't escape where they are. They're always going to be here. Even if you move them on a wall, they're really going to stay in the National Gallery, unless they're let out for good behavior on to some exhibition, traveling exhibition. Then they'll go off for a little while and then they'll come back. But it's all the same, a wall is a wall, isn't it?
We echo to each other. Who suffered most, who sat for longest, who's been restored, who got hidden during the war, who's been painting of the month, turned into a postcard, reprinted and sold a million times, catalogued, downloaded, our faces pressed and contorted. It seemed like flattery once. But in the hushed quiet of our own eternal night, we can't help but resent all this endless watching. We never realize that life is just a rough sketching, but now find we are layers and layers of everyone who ever looked at us.
I very much like the idea that what is truly deeply disturbing is the nearly animate, and it's the absence of soul. It's the absence of spirit, that kind of inertia, and that really makes one feel clammy and one wants to supply it. And I'm interested in playing and make-believe, because I think that a lot of playing and make-believe that children do actually attempts to supply this missing animation. They make their dolls play, they move their figures about, you know, with Playmobil or whatever. They try and breathe into it. And I think some of our creative urges later in life, which we see expressed in, you know, quite a lot of high art, is also a quality of bringing, of refusing this kind of image of death, this image of the inanimate, and bringing things to warm life. And it does stave off the fear of death at a very deep level that doesn't have to be conscious. This is not a sort of conscious process. This is an unconscious process of attraction and fear at the same time.
Sometimes it reminds me that my time will come sometime, and my time is close because I'm coming to retirement soon. And when you come to retirement, it means time to go. So sometimes when I'm in front of the altarpieces, I says, it's time to say your prayers, Joe, because it'll be judgment day someday.
I think the thing that's so captivating about a museum at night is the philosophical notion of, if a tree falls in a forest and no one's there, does it make a sound? I know it sounds crazy, but if there's nobody here to look at these paintings, do these paintings actually matter? Do they do exist. I accept that they exist, but do they matter? And I think I've found as a writer that my work, my books, don't fully exist until the reader reads them. It's like a contract between the reader and the writer, and I present something, I give something to the reader, they read it, and between the two of us, we make the whole work. And I think paintings are the same thing. Any kind of artwork is the same. The painter paints a painting, but what does it matter unless we actually look at it? So it's very curious to see it at night, like to come in when we came in just a minute ago and the lights were all dark and we couldn't see anything and we knew the paintings were there, but did they have that power? And oddly enough, sitting here in the dark when I couldn't see them, it took my eyes a few minutes to adjust, I still felt like they did. It was like they were zinging off the walls. There's like this buzz.
You demand that we remain constant. When sound folds itself into empty vaults of air and the last light fades like the dying echo of final footfall, we exhale.
Well, in the morning, about 5 o'clock, it's still kind of like quietish. You can start hearing the birds outside. Actually chippering, maybe it's their breakfast time, but you're actually going to hear them. And the next minute you get the buzzing noise on the door, and guess what's coming in? The karma is gone, everything's gone, it's bells ringing, phones ringing, and that's the cleaners, the contractors, the people who repair the doors. It's like there's a load of bees in the air, everything is busy, and you get feeling that the paintings are getting very busy and they're getting very tired. And they're waiting for me to get here at 8 o'clock and give them some free space and freedom.
You heard the voices of cultural historian Marina Warner, author Tracy Chevalier, poets Eyafi Mannix and Jacob Sam LaRose, and the night security staff at the National Gallery in London. The piece was produced by Kathy Fitzgerald and Neville Edwards for Antana International's audio tour of the museum, and it aired on ReSound from the Third Coast International Audio Festival in 2009. You can listen to more from Third Coast's archives at thirdcoastfestival.org, where you'll also find a link to subscribe to the ReSound podcast. That's it for today's episode of The Spot. You can find this episode and more at kalw.org. Look under the Programs tab. I love listening to your suggestions, so please take a moment and share a few of the podcasts that have hooked you recently. Just email me at thespot@kalw.org. And thanks for listening. I'm Ashley Ann Krigbaum. Tune in next Sunday, same time, for another episode of The Spot, only on 91.7 KALW, San Francisco.